Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Dablina Charcoalbordy.
And I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And it's probably no secret if you listen to the podcast a lot that we're both really big book lovers. But thus far, at least, I haven't been much of a book collector. I don't know about you, Sarah.
Me neither.
I know I would definitely like to at some point, and we've talked about this ever since I got my Kindle last year. I've been dreaming about only buying books that I want to collect.
First edition.
Exactly, but that hasn't started yet. So while I've amassed quite a few paperbacks and some random hardback books over the years, you could hardly call it a collection. So that's one of the biggest things that I learned from researching today's podcast, though, about George Ahrens. A bunch of books, no matter how valuable they are, does not a collection make.
And no matter how much you love them, if you only went out and chose your favorite authors and your favorite books, it wouldn't really make a collection. And Ahrens would really know what a collection was. He's been called, quote, one of the greatest contemporary bibliophiles. And over his lifetime, he created 2 separate book collections, which are now major collections at the New York Public Library. One is the Ahrens Tobacco Collection, which opened to the public in January of 1944. The other is the Ahrens Collection of Books and Parts and Associated Literature, which opened in February of 1957.
At this point, some of you out there, especially if you're not a bibliophile yourself, may be thinking, okay, so what? Why do I care about this guy who collected books?
And old books, too.
But what really makes Ahrens interesting, we think at least, besides the fact that he was also a businessman and an inventor, is the extremely focused approach that he took to his collections. He wasn't just collecting first editions, like Sarah mentioned before. His initial focus was simply tobacco, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more in a bit, of course. The other thing that really fascinated us was the process of hardcore book collecting that we learned about from researching this. Ahrens made book collecting into kind of an adventure, sometimes taking off across the pond at a moment's notice to pursue a volume that he really wanted.
He often compared it to a hunt, even.
Or a sport. And, of course, then there's the history of the books and the other items in the collections themselves. They have pretty cool stories behind them. Some have even come from the hands of the likes of Queen Elizabeth I. So we're going to cover all of these aspects.
Yeah, and to cover all of these aspects, we've decided to take kind of an atypical approach to this episode. We're going to give you some background on Ahrens first and how he got into collecting in the first place and some of the stories behind items in the collection. But we also had a terrific interview with Michael Inman, who who's the curator of the rare books division at the New York Public Library, where the Arendts collection is held. And he was a really great resource on the topic of Arendts, on his life, and on book collecting and rare books in general. So we're including parts of that interview in this podcast today as well.
But of course, before we get into all that, we need to tell you a little bit about Arendts and not only how he got the collecting bug, but also how tobacco became part of the equation.
Because it seems like a strange thing to have a collection centered around.
It does, but it won't in a couple minutes. George Arendts, who was technically George Arendts Jr., was born in New York City on May 7th, 1875. In a discussion of his family, you might find that the names can actually get kind of confusing, and it might be confusing if you try to look them up on your own, because obviously his father was also named George Arendts, and later on his son was as well. But we'll try to specify if we mention one of the other Georges in this podcast that we're doing so. So Arendts' family business was the Allen & Ginter Tobacco Company, which was established by his great-uncle, Major Louis Ginter. And this company was known for creating the first cigarette trading cards, which were slipped into cigarette packs to give them kind of that stiff quality. And they also served as a form of advertising. And this was even before kids' trading cards came around. So it was kind of venturing into new territory of a sort.
So because of the family business, Arendts spent a lot of time visiting Richmond, Virginia as a kid, because that was where the company was based. And in 1890, Allen & Ginter became part of the American Tobacco Company. I'm sure many of you have heard of that. But Arendts's family was still very much involved in that new company. And he started working there himself in 1896 between his junior and senior years studying at Columbia University. Then in 1897, he graduated from Columbia and he went on to earn his master's degree at Syracuse University. But he didn't just rest on getting a great education and settling into a comfortable job at the family business. He was enterprising, and he made his own name in that business as well. Around the turn of the century, he helped to establish the American Machine and Foundry Company and served as a director there, but he also got into some inventing.
He did, and I think we mentioned that in the intro of this podcast. One of his inventions in particular was a device that made it possible to make cigars with machines, and this was widely adopted in the industry. Later, it was developed into a machine that rolled cigarettes. I mean, before this, cigarettes had to be rolled by hand. So you can imagine how it would make mass production possible and really kind of revolutionize things. And these patents ended up being a great source of wealth for him.
So in a lot of our podcasts, we would probably stop with this sort of stuff, this business life of his. And in truth, a lot of podcast subjects stop there too. After all, I mean, if you're that accomplished, if you've made a name for yourself in business, if you're an inventor, why do you really need to do too much else? Some people might wonder. Of course, Arendts did have a personal life. He was married and he had two kids, a son and a daughter. We already mentioned the son. But along the way, he really went beyond his family life and his business life and took on a few hobbies too, mainly because of some advice he had gotten from his great uncle, Major Ginter, pretty early on. And there's an article by Sue Dickinson in Commonwealth Magazine where Arendts actually recounted this advice in a talk he gave at the College of William and Mary in 1939.
Yeah, he said, "On one of my many visits," and he's referring there to the visits to Virginia to visit his family, "Major Ginter gave me some advice which I have never forgotten. It has added greatly to my happiness and I think may be of value to many of you here. He said, 'When you are young, have many hobbies, but let your business or profession come first. As you grow older, you will have to abandon some of them. The more you have, the less you will miss those that you have to give up.'"
So Arendts really took this advice to heart, and he started taking on different hobbies, trying to collect as many early on as he could. One was race car driving, but that didn't last very long for him. He drove a Mercedes, which was car number 5, in the first Vanderbilt Cup race, which took place on Long Island in October of 1904. He was 29 years old at the time. It was his first race, but he got into an accident that left him pretty badly injured and actually killed his mechanic. So that was the end of that, perhaps kind of proving his uncle's point that you're going to have to abandon hobbies along the way.
One of his other hobbies, though, book collecting, of course, proved to be far safer than race car driving, and he did stick with that throughout his life. A bookseller, William Everts, warned Arendts early on that he should specialize when it came to book collecting. According to an article that Arendts prepared for Syracuse University students called "Book Collecting as I Have Found It," Everts said, "Do not buy some 16th and 17th century plays and poems, some 19th and 20th century novels. That is not a collection. It is just a lot of books. Decide on a subject which interests you and stick to it. Someday you may find that you have formed a great collection, or at least one which will always interest you.
So Arendts didn't have to think long and hard about what that focus of his collection would be, obviously. In that same William and Mary talk we mentioned earlier, Arendts said, quote, "What could be more natural for me, with the background of tobacco in my family, than to specialize on books relating to the divine herb?" So once he chose tobacco, he really went for it. But there's a bit of discrepancy regarding what work he started with and when exactly he started. Over the course of his life, he gave all sorts of ages, all pretty much on the younger side. But we wanted to talk to Michael Inman. What's the deal with this? What was his first book he bought? Here's what he had to say.
Arendts was in his early 20s when he bought his first book on tobacco. He bought his first book in 1898. And there is a discrepancy as to which work was the first book that he published. By most accounts, it was selections from original contributions by James Thompson to Copes's Tobacco Plant, which had been published in 1889. But there are other works, actually a couple of other works, which at one time or another he said that he had bought first. The discrepancy probably lies partly in his memory, and then also it lies in the fact that in his accession ledger, which he kept fairly careful notes in as to what he bought, he did list the selections from original contributions by James Thompson to have been the first book that he bought when he began collecting. So that's the book that I've always thought was probably was the first, or at least it's the first one of which we can be, you know, relatively certain.
So once Arendts' collection, his tobacco collection, got underway, he started out with the types of books you'd expect. Things with tobacco in the title or as the main subject. But even these focused works covered a broad range of takes on tobacco. There are history books, there are legal documents, books about the chemistry of tobacco, even medical texts. The oldest book in this collection is the first Latin edition of an account of Amerigo Vespucci's travels, which also contains the first reference to the New World as America. While tobacco isn't mentioned by name in this work, the book describes native people off of what is now Venezuela chewing green leaves. So the assumption is that they were chewing tobacco.
Yep. Another early piece from the collection includes the first mention of the Aztec reed cigarette and the first reference to tobacco smoking. And it even includes the first use of the word tobacco, which I think would have made a good find for our Oxford English Dictionary episode. But there are all sorts of items, like you said. Other items focus on herbals, for instance. One is a 1554 book that doesn't actually mention tobacco by name, but it contains the earliest illustration of it. So Arendts really was willing to look broadly at this.
In his essay, Tobacco Leaves, Arendts also talks about how he tried to collect books or documents that contain source material about the history of tobacco, like notes from the English Privy Council meetings, which I think is really interesting. It's through these documents that historians can trace the interlocking histories of tobacco, whether you're talking about the economic history, social, or political. And things aren't always positive either, or pro-tobacco.
As you might expect from somebody who had made his career in the tobacco industry.
Right. And one of Arendts' most prized works was actually King James I's Counterblast to Tobacco. Apparently, while Elizabeth I, James' predecessor and kinswoman, enjoyed tobacco after Sir Walter Raleigh helped popularize it in her court, James was not a very big fan himself.
No, and interestingly, Arendts' own copy was one James must have been pretty proud of, because it's part of a specially bound set that he had made for his wife, Queen Anne. Although Arendts believed that the works were in such pristine condition, he had a hunch Queen Anne must have never actually read her husband's works.
Another major tobacco opponent was John Smith, who was the author of A General History of Virginia. In it, he called tobacco, quote, "the heathenish weed," since it would drive settlers to waste their time planting that finicky crop instead of food that they actually needed to survive.
And we've talked about that connection between tobacco and Virginia before in an earlier episode, the episode on the shipwreck that saved Jamestown, really one of my favorites, where John Rolfe, famous for being Pocahontas's husband, managed to smuggle some Central American variety of tobacco seeds into Virginia and started producing the more popular crop there, where it really thrived and completely changed the economy of Virginia.
Yeah, and it really changed economies across the globe, too. Tobacco became kind of like an international currency of a sort. Eventually, Arents began to expand his collection to include titles that dealt with tobacco in a more tangential way, too. For example, he collected baseball cards from cigarette advertising, including a Honus Wagner from 1910. These are considered the most expensive baseball cards
very
around.
Rare. Honus Wagner apparently was not into having baseball cards made of him. But there are also things that I think would appeal to a lot of you guys. Alice in Wonderland, that's included because there's a caterpillar who smokes a hookah, and Arents collected a first edition of it. Moby Dick, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, all included in that collection just because they have some scene or some mention of tobacco that he thought was important enough.
So, of course, this made us really think of, I mean, you mentioned that Oxford English Dictionary, the William C. Minor podcast earlier, and that made us wonder, how did he find these references, some of which aren't really that obvious? And so we asked Michael Inman that very question, and here's what he had to say.
Well, some of them he came across, quite likely just in the course of his reading and in the course of collecting, he would find references to other works related to the subject. But I think it's safe to say that a great many of these works came to his attention through the advice or through information that was related to him by various book collectors and auction houses and so forth. He had people out there in the antiquarian book world who were on the lookout for items which had a tobacco connection, however slight. And as those items came into their stock, they would then contact him and ask if it was something that he was interested in acquiring, and then the transaction would take place. So it sort of went both directions in terms of his own research on the subject, and then also people on the lookout for things for him.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
One of the most notably missing figures, though, of this more tangential type of collection is William Shakespeare. And it's kind of strange because of that opposition from King James. There was apparently a lot of references done during Jacobin drama. You know, people like to talk about what was considered taboo. And Arendt even compared this to the multitude of alcohol references during Prohibition. But William Shakespeare is missing from Elizabethan, from Jacobin drama entirely. And there's a good reason for that. It's because he never wrote about tobacco. And Arendt at one point related a pretty funny story about Shakespeare and the lack of tobacco connections by talking about how he agreed to buy a Shakespeare first folio at one point if and only if a mention of tobacco could be found. And he got a little nervous about that promise afterwards because he was expecting there wouldn't be any mentions. And he knew that even for him, buying a Shakespeare first folio would be kind of a hurt on his bank
account.
Quite
an expensive venture.
Certainly. But the best anybody could find was a passage from A Midsummer Night's Dream about pipes. And fortunately for Arendt, it turned out to be about Oberon playing pipes of corn.
Different pipe.
Different kind of pipe. But I think it's so fascinating that Arendt's familiarity with all of these tangential references allowed him to actually draw some literary inferences from it. That total lack of tobacco references in Shakespeare's work contrasted with the frequent mentions of tobacco in Roger Bacon's work and ended up being proof enough for Arendt that Bacon did not write Shakespeare.
So finally, one of the most interesting lines of study in the collection is not just the history of tobacco, but the history of how tobacco was used. For example, a book by Christopher Columbus's natural son contains stories from Columbus's travels, including one describing Cuban Indians smoking cigars. Apparently, the sailors didn't know what was going on and thought perhaps the Indians were perfuming themselves with these cigars.
But it wasn't long, obviously, before the sailors took up smoking and started to take it back to the old world, even though folks back at home were pretty puzzled at first, you know, what was really going on. And one of the interesting items Arendt's collection includes is a record of a Spanish sailor being arrested during the Inquisition for smoke coming out of his mouth because he was having a smoke and folks thought that he must be possessed by the devil for something so horrifying to be happening. But by the time he got out of prison, he found that everybody around him was smoking. It had become commonplace during just that time he was put away.
The first sailors seen smoking in London created a riot. People thought that they were actually drinking smoke. But as smoking caught on in England, some elegant men felt that they actually needed smoking teachers, people who would teach you how to look good
while
you were smoking.
They wanted to look cool, yeah.
Not that it was okay at the time to walk around and smoke. Men would actually have to duck into apothecary shop, have a smoke, and then hit the streets again. So it made sense that tobacco was still considered medicinal by many, and that's why
connection there.
Exactly. So it was like you had an excuse to be smoking. Obviously, tobacco and smoking can be a really controversial topic today for health-related reasons, because of health-related concerns. Some of Arendt's inclusions reflect how it was controversial even throughout history. His collection contains critiques of tobacco through the ages, the earliest of which criticized the non-medicinal use of what was believed to be a medicine, as
we
just mentioned.
Very ironic when you think about today.
It reminded me a lot of the Radium Girls podcast that we did last fall and how people would thought that radium was medicinal and they would use it even to treat cancer and things like that. And then later they figured out, oh, it's actually causing cancer. And it's a similar sort of thing here with tobacco. One of the items that is in the collection, Tobacco Tortured from 1616, focuses on a degenerate family man who's ruined his life through tobacco. His wife pleads, quote, "Oh, my husband, why dost thou so vainly prefer a vanishing filthy fume before my permanent virtues? Have I not here brought forth an army of children unto thee?"
And the description of just this ragged man who's been destroyed by tobacco kind of reminds me of the classic after-school special almost, except that it's from 1616.
But thinking about all the controversies that have surrounded tobacco throughout the years and even up to today made us really wonder about how a collection of this sort is perceived. So we asked Michael about that. We asked Michael Inman, and he noted that they haven't really received a lot of flack for the tobacco collection, but that's probably because it's mostly historical. He said most of the volumes are actually pre-1900.
Well, and he also shared because of the huge number of items that aren't aren't really about tobacco. They just have that mention of it. About 50% of the people who use the collection, who consult it for their research, aren't really interested in the tobacco content at all. You know, they're interested in that Alice in Wonderland copy or the Wizard of Oz or whatever it may be, something completely apart from tobacco.
But tobacco wasn't all that Arents was interested in, as we mentioned in the intro to this podcast. In 1924, he started his second book collection, Books in Parts. So it was about a quarter of a century after he started that initial tobacco collection. And it just made us really curious. I mean, we had a sense of what books in parts are, but we wanted to talk to Michael a little bit about what that entails.
The Books in Parts collection is to my knowledge, is a unique collection. I mean, there are other rare book collections out there that have books in parts material, material in parts, I should say. But what makes the Arents collection of books in parts so special is that, so far as I know, it's the only collection of its kind that's solely predicated on collecting material in parts. And by parts, I mean these are original works of literature in a great many genres, which are still in their original serialized form in the individual paper wrappers that they came in. The practice would usually have been to have those individual parts bound up into one binding, but in fact, these actually remain in their original serialized form. I think that probably was part of the appeal for Arents, that here, just as had been the case with the tobacco part of the collection, which also, I believe, is fairly unique in the sense that it's solely predicated along those lines of just dealing with tobacco. Here was another aspect of book collecting that Arents could focus upon that really was something that was the other people weren't collecting at that time, at any rate.
Michael also went on to theorize that starting this second collection really allowed Arents a great avenue for a perfectionist to take. I mean, he was a perfectionist, and if you collect books in parts, you can gradually assemble not just a complete set, but a perfect set, something that was really appealing to Arents. But another reason why he might have started the second collection is that it allowed him to pursue the chase. You know, like we talked about earlier, the hunt behind book collecting, it allowed him to maintain the pace of book collecting he'd gotten used to.
Yeah, it was really an adventure for him, as we mentioned. I mean, Sarah and I were really taken with one part of an essay we read where it said that Arents would learn of a book that he wanted to get in London, and he would just decides on the spur of the moment
get on a boat.
Take off, get on a boat, and go get it. And that really excited us. So we wanted to talk to Michael a little bit about that thrill of the chase and ask him what his favorite story or what are some of the most interesting stories of how Arents obtained a volume. And here's what he had to say.
One that comes to mind is that for a great many years, he had had a nearly complete set of Hakluyt's Voyages. And not only was this is a terribly important work in terms of North American history, in terms of voyages and travels, and in terms of printing history, but also the particular set that he had acquired had belonged to Queen Elizabeth I. It bears her coat of arms on the binding. He had a complete set of that work. It's a multi-volume set, except for one volume that he was missing. And finally, persistence paid off. He had been searching for it for years and years, and it finally turned up at auction, and he was able to acquire that missing volume. But this is something that transpired over a great many years, that he doggedly pursued this one missing volume out of a multi-volume set. He was sort of like a dog with a bone. He wouldn't let go of something, and he always tried to acquire the complete work, as I mentioned earlier. So that's one example. He went to great lengths to acquire all sorts of items. Another example of something that he tried to come by over a period of years. We're very lucky in the Arents collection to have the original manuscript, the original four-act manuscript of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. And that's something that, again, he had to search for the complete set for a number of years, or the multi-volumes, because it's written in several notebooks. And he had to search for several years until he was able to assemble those two works.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
I think another thing that surprised us during our research was that this is not a static collection. It's something that's grown, and it's something that has been added to even after Aarons's death. And the library still, I don't know, Michael talked a little bit about what acquiring books is like today, and he said while he hasn't jetted to London to obtain materials, there is still that kind of thrill of the chase element to pursuing a book that is just perfect for the collection, something that has high research value but is also incredibly unique. And he said that they need to always, of course, focus on things that have a link to tobacco. That is the prime qualification for anything that's going to be in this collection. But it really does need to be important. It can't just mention tobacco. It has to almost live up to all the items that are already in the collection.
Right. He mentioned research value in particular. The items that they get must have some sort of research value, must have some sort of research value to them, I should say. And so, of course, talking about all of these volumes and their value made us really wonder, what are Michael's favorite things in this collection as the curator? And so we posed a kind of interesting scenario to him. Probably a nightmare, actually, for a curator like him. We asked, if the building were burning down, what would he take with him?
The importance of being earnest is one of my favorites, certainly. There is a handwritten letter from Queen Elizabeth I to Charles IX of France, in which she writes in French, in response to Charles's offer, he had offered his brother's hand in marriage to Elizabeth in order to forge an alliance between France and England. And so she wrote back to him in this very sort of flowery, circumlocutionary prose, "Oh, I love France and I adore you and I think your brother's great," and she goes on and on. And at the very end of the letter, she says rather tersely, sort of, "Thanks, but no thanks." That's a good example, again, of Aarons's very broad-mindedness in terms of collecting. For years, I wondered why that letter was in the collection, because there's no connection to tobacco that I can discern at all. And finally, after a number of years, I was able to find some notes that Arents had written where he explained that he had acquired that item simply because Elizabeth was the first modern female monarch who was known to smoke. So the connection there even was somewhat, you know, tenuous, but I suspect he saw that letter at auction or someone offered it to him, and it was just too tempting to pass up. So that's how he was probably able to justify acquiring it after the fact. So that letter, I think, there are several others from Sir Walter Raleigh and several other individuals from that period that are quite magnificent. There is another item that I really love is the first edition of The Wizard of Oz that Frank Baum inscribed to his mother. Very touching little inscription there where he writes a note to his mother. So that's certainly wonderful. It's really hard to sort of draw the line in just two or three. I think we're, you know, goodness forbid the building ever on fire, I would probably be in the building much longer than it was probably safe to be trying to grab as many things as I could. But certainly those would be a few of the top picks that come to mind. If you were to ask me the same question tomorrow, I probably would give you a completely different list and, you know, could keep going on for the next several months.
So that drastic scenario, you know, the building burning down, what are you going to save, kind of led us to a less drastic scenario, one of how are these materials preserved? How do people use them? And it was interesting to hear that because this is a library, a lot of these museum-worthy items are available to the public. You know, you can apply to consult with these materials and look at them yourself. Something I think...
Touch them.
Yes, touch them. Something that I think really sets rare book libraries like this apart.
Yeah, and Michael told us a little bit about the preservation and how meticulous they have to be to make sure that these volumes do stay intact so that people can use them in the future as well. And so that's a big aspect of keeping the collections there. It's not just curating them and finding the right volumes and the thrill of the chase. It's making sure that
they're around for a while.
That they're around for a while. And to that point, we also talked to him about the future of these collections, thinking about you guys especially. I mean, will these ever be available for people to see, even if you can't make a trip all the way to the main building of the New York Public Library on Fifth Avenue? And he mentioned that there is a digitization project going on at the New York Public Library, as I'm sure there are in many libraries around the world. And they're slowly, I think, converting all these volumes, or as many as they can, to digital versions. So someday you may be able to look this up from the comfort of your home.
Yeah, and that really does have two values to it. One, that if you have these high-quality reproductions, digital reproductions, not as many people need to touch that first manuscript of Importance of Being Earnest if they're researching it. But also, yeah, people who can't make it to New York can take a look at some of this stuff. Take a look at that baseball card or the counterblast or whatever it may be.
Obviously, that holds a lot of allure for us. We always need more materials for research, and so this was kind of a little bit of a vanity podcast for us, I guess, in that sense, because, or maybe that question in particular was, because we really would love to have access to these. But that's about all we have for this episode on George Arents and his collection. I would love to know if any listeners out there have their own collections, books or otherwise, that they've started as hobbies, side projects, and have seen grown throughout the years. I mean, I have hobbies, but my hobbies are like playing soccer or have been playing music or whatever. I haven't really collected anything ever, and that has always held a lot of fascination for me.
Well, and I really liked the idea of a focused book collection, because it meant that Arents, even when he was young, even when he didn't have a lot of money to spend on some of these more magnificent items or money to go off to London and collect a huge amount of works, he had a collection, even with just a few items, and that was the appeal. You know, if you have this focus to your collection, even a few books are a collection then. You don't need an entire library.
Well, I think that's a more hopeful way to look at it. So if you do have, if you've started, even if it's with just a few books, a book collection or any sort of collection, and you want to share that with us, please write us. We're at historypodcast@discovery.com. You can also look us up on Facebook or on Twitter at Missed in History.
And we also have a great article out there for all of you guys who are trying to choose the prime things you'll be adding to your future collection. It's called Top 10 Rare Books, and you can find it by searching on our homepage at www.howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway the great American race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.